Well, good morning, everyone. I have to train myself to say morning rather than afternoon. I'm used to speaking in the afternoon in Dallas, so good afternoon always just automatically comes out of my mouth. Also want to give a warm greeting to all of you out there that are watching this remotely, and particularly the Aussie brethren that will be watching this tomorrow. I'm sure a lot of them would appreciate your prayers there. I don't know if you've heard on the news, Australia has got some severe lockdowns that have been going on for some time. And in fact, for a number of the Australian brethren, even traveling outside of their home very far for the feast was not an option. So they're all having to keep it at home. In fact, I was speaking with one of the Australian brethren in the last few weeks, and a gentleman named Barry Keenevan, and he was asking me about the time zone, time zone difference between here and Australia. And he goes, maybe we want to tune in live. And I started laughing. I said, Barry, unless you want to watch services at 3 o'clock in the morning, I said, I think you're going to want to tune in the next day. I said, I think you're going to want to see it off the website. But, well, brethren, if I mentioned the Exodus out of Egypt and mentioned the holy days correlating with that, I'm sure your mind immediately goes to the Feast of Unleavened Bread and to Passover. And naturally it would, because those are directly correlated. They're memorials. You know, the unleavened bread, we're told in Exodus 13, is a memorial of coming out of Egypt. You probably don't think in terms of much of the Feast of Tabernacles correlating with that. But as we're going to see today, Leviticus 23 tells us the very name Feast of Tabernacles is tied to coming out of Egypt. So what we're going to do today is to look at that particular subject and see the parallels as to why that might be the case. You know, because oftentimes when we think of the Feast of Tabernacles, we think of the millennium, which rightly so, because it does picture that. But we oftentimes, again, don't think in terms of the Exodus, even though Leviticus 23, again, directly correlates them with each other. So if you like a title for the sermon, it's the Second Exodus. Again, the Second Exodus. And to see this, let's turn over to Leviticus 23, and we'll see the instructions here about keeping the Feast of Tabernacles. It's Leviticus 23. And we'll start reading in verse 33. It says, then Jehovah spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel, saying, the 15th day of the seventh month shall be the Feast of Tabernacles for 7 days to Jehovah. On the first day there shall be a holy convocation. You shall do no customary work in it. For 7 days you shall offer an offering made by fire to Jehovah. And on the eighth day shall be a holy convocation, and you shall offer an offering made by fire to Jehovah. It is a sacred assembly, and you shall do no customary work on it. These are the feasts of Jehovah, which you shall proclaim to be holy convocations, to offer an offering made by fire to Jehovah, a burnt offering and a grain offering, a sacrifice and drink offering, everything on its day. Besides the Sabbaths of Jehovah, besides your gifts, besides all of your vows, and besides all of your freewill offerings which you give to Jehovah. Also on the 15th day of the seventh month, when you have gathered all the fruit of your land, you shall keep the feast of Jehovah for 7 days. On the first day there shall be a Sabbath rest, and on the eighth day a Sabbath rest. And you shall take for yourselves on the first day the fruit of beautiful trees, branches of palm trees, boughs of leafy trees, and willows of the brook, and you shall rejoice before Jehovah your God for 7 days. And you shall keep a feast to Jehovah for 7 days in the year. And it shall be a statute forever in your generations. And you shall celebrate it in the seventh month. And you shall dwell in booths for 7 days. And all who are native Israelites shall dwell in booths. And notice that the very name Feast of Tabernacles comes from the fact that, you know, that we dwelt in booths. But now let's notice the next verse of what these booths are about. It's in verse 43. That your generations may know that I made the children of Israel dwell in booths when I brought you out of the land of Egypt. I am Jehovah your God. Now when you think about that, how often do we come to the Feast of Tabernacles, again, thinking about the Exodus out of Egypt? When you hear about that, we immediately think, that's the spring holy days. That's unleavened bread. Well, it is unleavened bread. That is what it's about. But again, that's also directly tied to the Feast of Tabernacles. Because what we see here is there's a parallel. You know, if you heard Rick's atonement sermon, he was talking about, you know, parallels within the holy days. You know, well, there's also parallels between, you know, the spring holy days and the fall holy days. Because, you know, the spring holy days, as we've, you know, taught for years, apply to the salvation process for the first fruits. Well, the fall holy days are all about God working with the rest of mankind. And you can see some of the same process working out here, you know, in all these holy days. What we're going to do today is look at, again, the parallels in the story of Exodus and how the events will play out with the Feast of Tabernacles, with the, you know, the millennium starting, and all the parallels together to see the connections that we oftentimes don't think about. You know, so let's turn over now to Exodus 13. And we'll see here the instructions for the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And as we're all familiar with, this is, you know, directly about the Exodus as well. It's Exodus 13 and verse 3. And Moses said to the people, "Remember this day in which you went out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. For by strength of hand, Jehovah brought you out of this place. No leavened bread shall be eaten. On this day you are going out in the month of the Aviv. And it shall be, when Jehovah brings you into the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, which he swore to your fathers to give you, a land flowing with milk and honey, that you shall keep in service this month. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. And on the seventh day there shall be a feast unto Jehovah. Unleavened bread shall be eaten 7 days, and no leavened bread shall be seen among you nor shall leaven be among in all your quarters. And you shall tell your son in that day, saying, this is done because of what Jehovah did for me when I came up from Egypt. And it shall be a sign to you on your hand and a memorial between your eyes, that Jehovah's law may be in your mouth, for with a strong hand Jehovah brought you out of the land of Egypt. You shall therefore keep this ordinance in its season from year to year." So notice, as we're all familiar, you know, unleavened bread is specifically a memorial of coming out of Egypt. But again, as we just read in Leviticus 23, the Feast of Tabernacles, you know, the very name Feast of Tabernacles comes from what? The temporary dwellings. And what were the temporary dwellings about? Remembering that you came out of Egypt. So let's look at the story here and kind of see the parallels and the meaning of what was taking place here. So let's turn over to Exodus 3. I just want to see some of the fundamentals of the story of the Exodus, kind of what was taking place here. Because I'm sure we're all familiar with the fact that, you know, the Exodus was delivering the Israelites out of slavery in Egypt. But there were several other things that were taking place here as well. So I want you to notice as we read through this, we're going to look at a couple of examples. But what we're going to see is not only with God appearing to Moses and giving him the instructions of what to do, but later when Moses and Aaron are appearing before Pharaoh, you'll see several things mentioned in the conversations. And there's two main purposes they're going to mention here, you know, as to why they need to leave. And it's not, you know, and of course, getting out of slavery is one of them. But you're going to see them mention that we need to leave here. We need to go 3 days' journey into the wilderness. And there's two purposes mentioned there. One is so we can sacrifice to our God, and then we can hold a feast to him. In other words, they needed to get out of this environment so they could get into an environment where they could freely worship God, and they could have a proper environment where they could have a good relationship with God. That was one of the purposes of why this was taking place. And for this to come about, as we know, all the plagues in Egypt, you know, had to, upon the Egyptians, had to take place for them to get the freedom to be able to leave and do that. But you'll see these three elements mentioned as we read through some examples here. So we're going to start in Exodus 3 and verse 15, and this is the burning bush incident. It says, "Moreover, God said to Moses, thus you shall say to the children of Israel, Jehovah, God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and this is my memorial to all generations. Go and gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, Jehovah, God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob, appeared to me, saying, I have surely visited you, and you have seen what I've done in Egypt. And I have said, I will bring you out of affliction, out of Egypt, to the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, to the land flowing with milk and honey. And then you will heed your voice, and you will come, and you and the elders of Israel, to the king of Egypt, and you will say to him, Jehovah, God of the Hebrews, has met with us. Now, please let us go 3 days' journey into the wilderness, that we may sacrifice to Jehovah our God. Notice here, one of the purposes, again, not just getting out of slavery, but they need to go out 3 days' journey into the wilderness. And what this meant was going off, you know, through Egyptian territory, through the Red Sea, and then 3 days' journey into the wilderness is the way the story played out. But again, notice here he's mentioning sacrificing. Well, in one of the next verses we're going to look at is mentioning having a feast unto him, but because they needed to get out of this environment to properly worship God. And then picking up in verse 19, "But I am sure the king of Egypt will not let you go, no, not even by a mighty hand. So I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all my wonders, and I will do in its midst. After this, he will let you go." So notice, it was one of these things that the plagues in Egypt also had to take place, because Pharaoh didn't just hear them say, you know, Moses say, "Let my people go," you know, for God to go, "Okay, I'll comply, you can go." You know, it didn't work like that. You know, he had to bring upon a series of plagues upon them to basically level the Egyptian, you know, society and totally bring them to their knees before this would happen. You know, and as we're going to see here, as we parallel this with how the millennium starts, that's what the day of the Lord does as well. Now turn over to Exodus chapter 5, because as I mentioned, it doesn't just mention sacrificing to God. It also mentions how having a feast unto him. It's Exodus 5 and verse 1. "So afterwards Moses and Aaron went in and told Pharaoh, 'Thus says Jehovah God of Israel, let my people go, that they may hold a feast to me in the wilderness.' And Pharaoh said, 'Who is Jehovah that I should obey his voice and let Israel go? I do not know Jehovah, nor will I let Israel go.' And they said, 'The God of the Hebrews has met with us. Please let us go 3 days' journey into the desert and sacrifice to Jehovah our God, lest we fall upon us with pestilence or with the sword.'" So notice again that you have a couple elements here of sacrificing to him and also holding a feast. Again, they needed to be out of Egyptian territory, you know, and out of this environment to have a properly, you know, environment to worship God. Because we're going to see here in the next scripture we're going to look at in Exodus chapter 8, Pharaoh offers Moses the option of, okay, well, you can worship your God. You can sacrifice to him and hold a feast. Just do it here in Egypt, you know, do it here in this territory. And Moses says, no, that's not going to work. We've got to get out of here to make that happen. So it's Exodus chapter 8 and verse 25. "And Pharaoh called to Moses and Aaron and said, 'Go sacrifice to your God in the land.'" In other words, do it in Egyptian territory. Verse 26, "And Moses said, it is not right to do so, for we would be sacrificing the abomination of the Egyptians to Jehovah our God. If we sacrifice the abomination of the Egyptians before their eyes, then will they not stone us? We will go 3 days' journey into the wilderness and sacrifice to Jehovah our God as he will command us." So notice it wasn't just an issue of delivering them from slavery. You know, and that was an important part as well. It was also getting out of this environment so that, again, they could then start to worship God and have a proper relationship with him. And what I want you to see here is the same kind of parallel is going to take place on a global scale as how the events that set up the millennium, but because that's the point where God starts working with all of mankind. So to notice, first of all, turn over to Revelation chapter 11. I just want you to notice how it uses the analogy of Egypt in referring to what's happening at that time. It's in Revelation 11. We're going to read a brief mention here in regards to the two witnesses. And that's another interesting parallel as well, because I'm sure we're all familiar. At the end time, there's going to be, you know, the two witnesses, you know, prophesying, you know, and being a witness to the beast power and such, and announcing what God's going to be doing, you know, with all the plagues of the day of the Lord. Well, doesn't that story kind of sound familiar? And that's what Moses and Aaron did. You know, they were constantly going before, you know, the Pharaoh and the Egyptian powers there, which is, you know, directly analogous to the end time beast power, and telling them, you know, here's what God's going to do to you next, you know, and they would announce each of the plagues that are taking place. Well, during the day of the Lord, you have a series of plagues that take place as well, again, that also level the society. But just notice here the connection of how it ties this with Egypt. This is Revelation 11 and verse 7. Now when they finish their testimony, and it's referring to the two witnesses here, the beast that ascends out of the bottomless pit will make war against them, overcome them, and kill them. And their bodies will lie in the street of the great city, which spiritually is called Sodom and Egypt, where also our Lord was crucified. So notice how it directly, it connects it with Egypt. I mean, obviously it's a spiritual analogy, but because we know, Egypt is a picture of sin. Because often talk about coming out of Egypt as being analogous to coming out of sin. Well, you see a similar connection here. And to be able to, for God to have a proper, a relationship with all of mankind and to work with them, he's got to level on a global scale, the society and the culture of the world at that point, very similar to what he did with the Egyptians. But because he brings upon all these plagues upon the Egyptians, and by the time that all that was over, Egypt had been brought to their knees, and their society somewhat destroyed. Well, the day of the Lord's going to do a very similar thing on a global scale. Let's notice over in Revelation 18. That Babylon at that time needs to be brought down because God's got to bring his people out of this. It's Revelation 18 and verse 1. After these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illuminated with his glory. And he cried mightily with a loud voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen, and has become a habitation of demons, a prison of every foul spirit, and a cage of every unclean and hated bird. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication, and the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury. Because notice, it's not just Egypt that's the problem. The whole globe, the entire world has been in engulfed in this system. And I heard another voice coming from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins, lest you receive of her plagues. For her sins have reached to heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. Render her just as you render to you, and repay her double according to her works. And the cup in which she has mixed, which she has mixed of her double. In the measure that it's glorified herself and lived luxuriously, in the same measure give her torment and sorrow. For she says in her heart, I sit as queen and am no widow and will not see sorrow. Therefore her plagues will come in one day, and in death and mourning and famine, and they will be utterly burned with fire, for strong is the Lord God who judges her. And notice that they have to be brought down with a series of plagues as well. Well, that's what occurs during the day of the Lord. Because, the events of the day of the Lord bring this society to its knees, and set up, basically set the scene for Christ and the Father to return and to set up the millennium. So to briefly look at that, turn over to Isaiah chapter 2. Passage here that directly addresses the day of the Lord. It's Isaiah chapter 2. And we'll start reading in verse 12. It says, for the day of Jehovah of hosts shall come upon everything proud and lofty, and upon everything lifted up, and it shall be brought low upon the cedars of Lebanon that are high and lifted up, and all of the oaks of Bashan, upon all the high mountains and upon all the hills that are lifted up, upon every high tower and upon every fortified wall, and upon the ships of Tarshish and upon all the beautiful slopes. The loftiness of man shall be bowed down, and the haughtiness of men shall be brought low. And Jehovah alone will be exalted in that day. But the idols he shall utterly abolish. And they shall go into the holes of the rocks and into the caves of the earth from the terror of Jehovah and the glory of his majesty. And he arises to shake the earth mightily. And in that day, man shall cast away his idols of silver and idols of gold that they made, each for himself to worship, and to the moles and bats, and to go in the cliffs of rocks, into the crags of the rugged rocks, from the terror of Jehovah, and the glory of his majesty, when he arises to shake the earth mightily. So see, what's going to happen here is, during the day of the Lord, the plagues are basically going to bring the entire planet to its knees, you know, similar to how the plagues in Egypt brought the Egyptian society down to its knees, you know, and just leveled the place. And to see how this is going to play out, not only are you going to have, again, these, you know, similar plagues, you know, that basically in a series of events brings the society down to its knees. Another interesting parallel between the two is, remember, with the Exodus, after all of the plagues played out and the Egyptians, you know, and the Israelites are leaving, what was the final thing that happened? Well, Pharaoh's army gets destroyed. It gets drowned in the Red Sea. And we're going to see a parallel directly between that and the events of the day of the Lord. So turn over to Exodus chapter 14. Exodus chapter 14, we'll start in verse 21. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and Jehovah caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all the night, and made the sea into dry land, and the waters divided. So the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea on the dry ground, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. And the Egyptians pursued after them into the midst of the sea, and all of Pharaoh's horses, his chariots and his horsemen. Now it came to pass in the morning watch that Jehovah looked down upon the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and cloud, and they troubled the army of the Egyptians. And he took off their chariot wheels, so that they drove them with difficulty. And the Egyptians said, "Let us flee from the face of Israel, for Jehovah fights for them against the Egyptians." And Jehovah said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the sea," and the waters came back upon the Egyptians and their chariots and all the horsemen. And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea when the morning appeared, and the sea returned to its full depth, while the Egyptians were fleeing into it. So Jehovah overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea, and the waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen and all the army of Pharaoh that came into the sea after them. Not so much as one of them remained. But the children of Israel had walked on dry land in the midst of the sea and the waters and the wall to them on their right hand and on their left. So Jehovah saved Israel that day out of the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. Well, as we're going to see here in the book of Revelation, a very similar event takes place with the beast's army as well. You know, that is basically one of the final events that takes place in the day of the Lord. So turn over to Revelation chapter 19. Revelation chapter 19 and verse 17. And then I saw an angel standing in the sun, and he cried with a loud voice, saying to all the birds that fly in the midst of heaven, "Come and gather together for the supper of the great God, that he may eat the flesh of kings and the flesh of captains, the flesh of mighty men, the flesh of horses, and of those who sit on them, and the flesh of all people, free and slave, both small and great." And I saw the beast of the kings of the earth and their armies gathered together to make war against him, and sat on the horse and against his army. And then the beast was captured with him and the false prophet, who worked signs in the presence by which they deceived those who received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. And the two were cast alive into the lake of fire burning with brimstone. And the rest were killed with the sword that proceeded from the mouth of him who sat on the horse, and all the birds were filled with their flesh. So you can see there's a number of parallels in how these events play out, you know, and again, throughout the day of the Lord, very similar, you know, to how things played out before the Exodus, you know, with Israel coming out of Egypt. I mean, even down to the fact of you essentially have two witnesses, you know, because Moses and Aaron essentially functioned very similarly, you know, going before what you could say was kind of the beast power of their time, you know, before Pharaoh in Egypt, and announcing God's will and announcing the plagues that would come upon them. You know, whether two witnesses fulfill a similar role. Well, there's another interesting event that takes place here as well. Because if you think about this, if you're just working with a single nation, like God was working with ancient Israel, you know, you can get them into a proper environment to try to worship God by simply moving them from point A to point B. In other words, you know, they were in Egypt, and God says, well, I've got to get you out of here. You know, we got to march you out of Egyptian territory through the Red Sea, 3 days into the wilderness. Then you'll be in a free environment, not steeped in all this idolatry, not under this oppression, you know, and then you'll be able to worship me and have a proper relationship. Well, if you're trying to do this with the entire planet, it's not really going to work to move people from point A to point B, is it? Because you're trying to work with everybody everywhere. So what you have to do in a situation like that, you can't just physically move the people out of Egypt. You basically got to take the Egypt environment and move it away from them entirely. Well, let's just see how that happens in the next verse. Revelation 20 and verse 1. And then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the key to the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand. And he laid hold of the dragon, the serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. And he cast him into the bottomless pit and shut him up and set a seal upon him so that he should deceive the nations no more till the 1,000 years were finished. But after these things, he must be released for a little while. See, the binding of Satan will wind up accomplishing that objective. Because again, you can't just take these people and say, well, this environment's really bad, let's move you over there. You know, because if you're trying to work with everybody, you've got to make a positive environment for everybody. Well, if you take Satan out of the equation, in that constant broadcasting of that, you know, that sinful messages to everybody, you basically make a positive environment of the planet. And then this is what, you know, this is one of the fulfillments of the Day of Atonement. Is the binding of Satan, because again, this helps set the stage so that you can have what's pictured by the Feast of Tabernacles, you know, the millennium. So now to think about this, realize I'm sure we're all familiar in studying the spring holy days. You know, one of the things that we look at is, you know, not only after the Egyptians, I mean, after the Israelites came out of Egypt, you know, and they're freed from slavery, because all this time they're crying out to God, you know, please deliver us out of this horrible environment and such. Well, what happened? You know, he gets them out of that, and what do they want to do? Oh, we miss Egypt. We want to go back, you know. Oh, if only we had the good things that we had in Egypt. You know, so suddenly they forget about that, and then they want to go back into that sinful environment. We're going to see some similar parallels here as well. So first of all, let's turn over to Exodus 16. Let's just notice how the Israelites behaved. You know, these same people who were crying out for deliverance, you know, we hate this oppression and this slavery. Please deliver us from this. As soon as they get out and something doesn't go the way that they want, what are they wanting to do? It's Exodus chapter 16. We'll start reading in verse 1. And they journeyed from Elam, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elam and Sinai. And on the 15th day of the second month, after they departed from the land of Egypt. And then the whole congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And the children of Israel said to them, "Oh, that we had died in by the hand of Jehovah in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of the meat, and when we ate the bread to the full, and we were brought us out into this wilderness to kill us, this whole assembly, with hunger." In other words, they suddenly forgot about how oppressed they were and how much they wanted to be freed from this environment. And they're like, "Oh, we want to go back. Things were better there." Well, notice this was a constant theme. Turn over to Exodus 17. Exodus 17, we're going to see this happen again. And then all the congregation of the children of Israel set out on their journey from the wilderness of Sin, according to the commandment of Jehovah, and encamped in Rephidim. But there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore the people contended with Moses and said, give us water that we may drink. And Moses said to them, Why do you contend with me? Why do you tempt Jehovah? And the people thirsted there for water. And the people murmured against Moses and said, why is it you brought us out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst? In other words, we wish we could go back. You know, things were better there. How quickly they forgot. Well, the same kind of thing is going to happen in the end time as well. Turn over to Revelation chapter 18. Let's notice how the world responds when the beast power is leveled, you know, and the beast and the false prophet are killed, and they're, you know, the whole system is brought down. Let's pick up here in Revelation 18 and verse 9. And the kings of the earth who committed fornication and lived luxurious with her will weep and lament for her, when they see the smoke of her burning, standing at a distance for fear of her torment, saying, alas, alas, that great city Babylon, that mighty city, for in 1 hour her judgment has come, and the merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her, for no one buys her merchandise anymore, merchandise of gold and silver, precious stones and pearls, fine linen, purple, silk, and scarlet, every kind of citron wood, every kind of object of ivory, every kind of object of most precious wood, bronze, iron, and marble, and cinnamon and incense, fragrant oil and frankincense, wine and oil, the flour and wheat, cattle and sheep, horses and chariots, and bodies and souls of men. And the fruit of your soul longed for has gone from you. And all the things which are rich and splendid have gone from you, and you shall find them no more at all. The merchants of these things who became rich by her will stand at a distance for fear of her torment, weeping and wailing, and saying, alas, alas, that great city that was clothed in fine linen, purple and scarlet, and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls. For in 1 hour such great riches came to nothing. And every shipmaster, all who traveled by ship, sailors, and as many as trade on the sea, stood at a distance and cried out when they saw the smoke of her burning, saying, what is like this great city? And they threw dust in their heads and cried out, weeping and wailing and saying, alas, alas, that great city in which all who had ships on the sea became rich by her wealth. For in 1 hour she is made desolate. Rejoice over her, O heavens, and you holy apostles and prophets, for God has avenged you on her. Now notice the people weren't thinking, oh great, this horrible system is gone. They're just like the Israelites. Oh, we want to be back in Egypt. We want to have all the things that we enjoyed there before. The same movie is going to play out again. You know, and notice even after the millennium starts, there's still going to be people resisting, insisting that they want to do their own way. Turn over to Zechariah chapter 14. Zechariah chapter 14. And it shall come to pass that everyone who is left of all the nations which came against Jerusalem shall go up from year to year to worship the King, Jehovah of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. And it shall be that whichever of the families of the earth do not come up to Jerusalem to worship the King, Jehovah of hosts, on them there will be no rain. If the family of Egypt will not come up and enter in, and they shall have no rain, and they shall receive the plague upon which Jehovah strikes the nations who do not come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles.
This is the punishment of Egypt and the punishment of all the nations who do not come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. Because, you know, a lot of times we look at this and we think, well, what wouldn't the world just be so overjoyed that, you know, you have this replenished earth and things are in peace, and wouldn't they just want to fall in line and worship God and be so appreciative of all of this? Well, obviously not everyone's going to think like that immediately. You know, there's going to be people going, no, we want to do our own way. We want to do our own thing. He wants us to go down to Jerusalem. Well, I'm not going. You know, there's going to be, you know, having to deal with this type of attitude with people. Well, because we have to realize realistically what the environment's going to be like working with all of these people. Because we know part of our job as first fruits is to be kings and priests, you know, during this time and working with the rest of mankind. And sometimes we get these very idealistic views of, you know, well, the millennium starts and Satan is bound and everybody just jumps in line and we just start teaching them the finer points of doctrine and, you know, going over, you know, the heavy meat of the word. That makes for great anecdotal stories. It has very little correlation with reality. Because think about the reality of the people that you're dealing with. And let's just start with just looking at how God worked with ancient Egypt. I mean, with ancient Israel, when he brought them out of Egypt. You know, let's notice when he first started off working with them and got them out of this environment, he doesn't immediately drop everything on the meaning of the holy days and what everything is about. He starts off with, there are 7 days in a week. The seventh day is the Sabbath. You don't work that day. Let's notice that. Turn over to Exodus chapter 16. Exodus chapter 16. And we read the first couple of verses here, so we know kind of the scene that this is where, you know, they're hungry and they're all complaining. But let's notice his solution to that. This is where he introduces the concept of manna. And manna wasn't just a way to feed them. Manna was also a way to make it painfully obvious which day is the Sabbath. So pick up here in verse 4. And Jehovah said to Moses, behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you. And all the people shall go out and gather a certain quota every day, that I may test them whether they will walk in my law or not. And it shall be on this sixth day that they will prepare what they bring in, and it shall be twice as much as they gather daily. So notice he was purposely making this a situation where essentially food fell from the sky 6 days a week. You know, and all the first 5 days, if they tried to keep any over the next day, well, it was bad and it spoiled. But on the sixth day, they get twice as much, and because there's enough for the Sabbath. And the one day of the week that food doesn't fall from the sky is it's the seventh day of the week. This is painfully obvious. I mean, a good friend of mine used to joke about things being stupid-proof. You know, you want something that's so clear it's stupid-proof. You can't be so stupid as to miss it. Well, this is stupid-proof. You know, I mean, the seventh day of the week, food doesn't fall from the sky. That's the Sabbath. You can't miss this. You know, but let's notice kind of Israel's reaction with this one. Go down to verse 11. Then Jehovah spoke to Moses, saying, I have heard the murmuring of the children of Israel. Speak to them, saying, at twilight you shall eat, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread, and you shall know that I am Jehovah your God. So it was, the quails came up at evening and covered the camp. In the morning, the dew laid all around the camp. And when the layer of dew lifted up on the surface of the wilderness, all of this small round substance of fine as frost on the ground. And the children of Israel saw it, and they said to one another, what is it? For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, this is the bread which Jehovah has given you to eat. And this is the thing which Jehovah has commanded. Let every man gather it according each to one's needs, one omer for each person according to the number of persons. Let every man take for those who are in his tent. And the children of Israel did so and gathered some more and some less. So when they measured it by omers, he who gathered much had nothing over, and he who gathered little had no lack. And every man who gathered according to his one's needs. And Moses said, let no one leave any of it until morning. Notwithstanding, they did not heed Moses. For some of them left part of it until morning, and it bred worms and stank. And Moses was angry with them. So they gathered it every morning, every man according to his need. And when the sun became hot, it melted. And so it was on the sixth day they gathered twice as much bread, 2 omers for each of them. And all the rulers of the congregation came and told Moses. Then he said to them, "This is what Jehovah has said. Tomorrow is a Sabbath rest, a holy Sabbath to Jehovah. Bake what you shall bake today, and boil what you shall boil, and lay on yourselves the remains to be kept until morning." So they laid up until morning as Moses commanded, and it did not stink, nor were there any worms in it. Then Moses said, eat that today, and for today is a Sabbath to Jehovah. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather, but on the seventh day, which is the Sabbath, there will be none. Now it happened that some of the people went out on the seventh day to gather, but they found none. And Jehovah said to Moses, "How long do you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? See, for Jehovah has given you the Sabbath. Therefore he gives you on the sixth day bread for 2 days. Let every man remain in his place, and let no one but man go out in his place on the seventh day." And the people rested on the seventh day. So notice he gave them something very simple. You know, there are 7 days in a week. The seventh day is the Sabbath. You don't work that day. You can't miss it. It's the one day that food doesn't fall from the sky. You know, this is kind of stupid proof. You know, but still you've got people resisting because this is where the level of where people are at. Well, it's going to be very similar for us working with the rest of mankind. Because realize you've got people from all manner of backgrounds. Not only do you have all these people that have lived through the day of the Lord who are just absolutely traumatized, you know, from what they have witnessed, but you've got lots of other people resurrected back to life, you know, from all manner of backgrounds. And a lot of them who've never even heard of a Bible before, you know, and for a lot of them, it's going to be more than just saying, here's a Bible, this is the book you need to read. You know, for a lot of them, it's going to be, there's a God. There's a creator God. You mean there's somebody who actually made all of this? And it's not Baal, it's not Ra, it's not Zeus. You know, there's Jehovah's actually the God that we're supposed to worship. You know, for a lot of them, it's going to be just even realizing there is a God and that he makes the rules and we don't. Because it's going to be starting off at a very basic level, working with people, because again, that's where a lot of these people are going to be at. And it's realized a lot of our job is going to be similar to what we see described in Ezekiel 44 in regards to the responsibilities of priests during the millennium. So turn over to Ezekiel 44. It's Ezekiel 44, verse 23. We're going to briefly look at kind of the job description here for the physical priesthood that's going to exist during the millennium. And they shall teach my people the difference between the holy and the unholy, and cause them to discern between the unclean and the clean. In controversy they shall stand as judges, and judge it according to my judgments. And they will keep my laws and my statutes and all my appointed meetings, and they shall hallow my Sabbaths. You see, basic distinctions are going to be one of the basic places or where we have to start with a lot of these people. Because again, I think sometimes we have an unrealistic view when we look at the millennium, because we think, okay, people will just be so overjoyed to learn God's way, you know, that the earth will be healed, it'll be a utopian environment, Satan will be bound, and everybody will just be enthusiastic to jump in there and learn God's way. That's not really realistic. I'm sure there are some people that will be, but a lot of people are going to be, again, they're going to need to first learn there is a God. You know, that there is a God. He is our creator. He's our owner, and we are not equals. You know, and he gets to make the rules, and we have to listen and follow him. You know, but before they're going to be real interested in learning all the finer details of this book, there's a few basic concepts they've got to get, because again, a lot of these people are going to kind of come up from totally pagan societies or were totally atheists, you know, and they're going to start with learning there's a God, you know, and he makes the rules and I don't, You know, and life goes a lot better if we listen to him because he understands how things work better. But again, they're going to have to go through the same painful process that a lot of us have to do to realize, you know, maybe I should listen to him. Things work better when we do it that way. You know, because one of the basic fundamental things of, you know, mankind, and it's not just extant in, you know, in our society today, you know, we hear a lot about equality and equity and that type of thing. Well, if we look back from the very beginning, even before mankind, what was one of the major problems? We can see with Satan, what was he trying to do? Be equal with God. He thought it was all about equality, and he had to learn the hard way. No, God's the boss. I'm not. You know, he never really got that lesson, but that's fundamentally what this problem was about. So turn over to Isaiah 14. So Isaiah 14, we'll see here in verse 12. How have you fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How are you cut down to the ground? You are weakened, you who weakened the nations. For you have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will also sit on the mount of the congregation. On the farthest side of the north, I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. In other words, I will be his equal. I'll be just like him. Nobody's ever his equal. You know, it doesn't work like that. You know, and that's a lesson we all have to learn. But notice when Satan approaches Eve in the Garden of Eden, he used the exact same sales pitch. Let's turn over to Genesis chapter 3. Genesis chapter 3 and verse 1. Now the serpent was more cunning than any beast of the field which Jehovah God had made. And he said to the woman, has God indeed said, you shall not eat of every tree of the garden? And the woman said to the serpent, we may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden, but the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God has said, you shall not eat of it, nor shall you touch it, lest you die. And the serpent said to Eve, you shall not surely die, for God knows that in the day you eat of it, your eyes will be open, and you will be like God. You'll be equal with him, knowing good and evil. So the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was pleasant to the eyes, and the tree desirable to make one wise. She took of the fruit and ate. And she also gave to her husband with her, and he ate. Then the eyes of both of them were open, and they knew that they were naked, and they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves coverings. Essentially, his sales pitch was, if you're being cheated out of equality, God wants to oppress you and hold you down. Here, eat this fruit. It's empowering. That's essentially the sales pitch that he gave her. But again, isn't that one of the most fundamental problems we have as mankind throughout our lives, learning that God's the boss, I'm not, I have to surrender my will to his because he knows better, he makes the rules, and I don't. Well, at least getting a basic concept of that idea, you know, that there is a God, that he makes the rules and we don't, that's the first step before you're really interested in learning all the finer details of this book. Because you have to realize that it's relevant to you, that you know it's going to be meaningful for your life. And for a lot of these people, that's where we're going to be starting. Again, not necessarily, you know, enthusiastically jumping in to learn all the details, is taking them baby steps along the way to build a foundation so that they are interested in this. Let's also look at a brief lesson of how Nebuchadnezzar himself had to learn this lesson the hard way. Turn over to Daniel chapter 4. Because notice what was Nebuchadnezzar's problem. He thought he had accomplished everything on his own. He essentially thought he was equal. He had already had a dream where, you know, it was revealed to him that the reason that he had all that he has and why he is in power is because the Creator God gave all this to him. That's how he had it. Well, he still didn't learn the lesson. It's in Daniel chapter 4 and verse 28. And all this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar. At the end of the 12 months, he was walking about in the royal palace of Babylon. And this king spoke, saying, is this not great Babylon that I have built for a royal dwelling for my mighty power and for honor and for my majesty? And while the words were still in his mouth, a voice fell from heaven. King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken that the kingdom has departed from you, and they shall drive you from men, and your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and they shall make you eat grass like oxen. And seven times will pass over you until you know that the Most High rules in the kingdoms of men and gives it to whomever he chooses. That very hour, the word was fulfilled concerning Nebuchadnezzar. He was driven from men and ate grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, so his hair was grown like eagle's feathers and his nails like bird's claws. In verse 34, and at the end of the time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven, and my understanding returned to me. And I blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generation. And all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. And he does according to his will in the army of heaven, and among the inhabitants of the earth, no one can restrain his hand or say to him, what have you done? In other words, it took the pain level, you know, to get very high for him to finally start paying attention and realizing, maybe I should listen. Maybe I should pay attention and listen to what God has to say. Now, remember what we just read previously in Zechariah 14. Where you have nations, you know, during the millennium, at a time when Satan's not there, he's been bound, you have this utopian, peaceful environment, but you still got people going, nah, I'm not coming down to Jerusalem for the Feast of Tabernacles. I got something else to do. So what does God have to do? Okay, we'll switch off the rain for a while. We'll let the pain level get high enough till you start paying attention. You know, and when that starts to hurt for a while, maybe you'll reconsider this decision and go, maybe I should listen to him. Maybe I should make a point of, you know, of making that trip down to Jerusalem and do what he has to say. You know, maybe the life will work out better that way. See, these people are going to have to learn that lesson as well, you know, because some of them are going to be hardheads, you know, and because, again, that's human beings. But we all have to go through that process. But again, to have a realistic idea of what our job is going to look like, we have to realize that's where a lot of these people are going to be. Because yes, for a lot of people that live through the day of the Lord, they've seen some incredible things and demonstrations of God's power. But realize there's also a good number of people who get resurrected, you know, who skip the whole day of the Lord situation. You know, their life ended in whatever circumstances, you know, that their life was experiencing. And then they come back to life and there's a utopian setting and the earth is healed and everything looks great. They didn't learn the lessons of, you know, kind of going through those painful, you know, experiences. So they're going to be starting at that basic level. And we've got to realize with them. Again, you start off again with just the very basic distinction of there's a God, he's your creator, he's your owner, you are not equals. You know, he makes the rules, and if you're smart, you listen to them. You know, and we have to realize that he defines what's right and wrong. He defines good and evil, and you don't. You see, another basic lesson people will have to learn, we find over in Proverbs chapter 14. It's Proverbs 14 and verse 12. There is a way that seems right to a man, but its end is the way of death. Because imagine, you've got nations told you, you need to send people down to Jerusalem to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. Well, you know, most people that, you know, have ever kept the Feast of Tabernacles and are enjoying the abundance, this is not something you see as oppressive. You know, this is a time we look forward to. It's a time of abundance. It's something joyful, you know. And if people are willing to fight that, that kind of tells you about where their attitude is at. You know, and again, it's a process of, because they think their way is better. You know, but we have to realize that, you know, everyone has to learn that basic lesson that if we do it our own way, what do we tend to do? We tend to call evil good and good evil. We turn to invert things and get it all upside down. Turn over to Isaiah chapter 5. It's Isaiah chapter 5 and verse 20. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter to sweet and sweet for bitter. And see, that's what we as human beings tend to do. Now, obviously, Satan's influence pours Miracle-Gro on that, and makes it dramatically worse. But again, as we can just see from the example in Zechariah, it's not like that when Satan's out of the equation, people just immediately want to, always obey and never want to do their own thing. There's still going to be stubborn people that want to do their own thing. And what they have to basically learn is, again, if we insist on doing our own way, we tend to get it all backwards and upside down. So they have to learn the lesson that we have to yield to God's will. If we turn over to Proverbs chapter 3, we'll see a basic scripture I think we're all familiar with. But again, this will be news to a lot of these people. It's Proverbs chapter 3 and verse 5. Trust in Jehovah with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him and he will direct your paths. See, these are going to be people that this doesn't come natural to. This is something that, again, they're going to learn through trial and error as well, and making their own mistakes, and sometimes having to have the pain level, raised up for them, where they start realizing, okay, when I do it my way, it doesn't turn out so well, and life tends to hurt, and I it's kind of the painful way of doing things. Maybe I should be smarter and start listening to him. They'll have to learn that lesson through some trial and error as well. Again, it'll certainly be easier without the influence of Satan. But we got to realize that that's what we're going to need to do. It's like, Rick was talking about yesterday, how we want to rule. Well, with patience and kindness and gentleness with people, because again, they're going to have to go through their bumpy process of learning by some trial and error as well. Because what they have to learn is that God's way defines what's right and wrong. If you turn over to another scripture we're all very familiar with. This is 1 John chapter 3. 1 John chapter 3 and verse 4. It says, whoever commits sin also commits lawlessness, for sin is lawlessness. And so you have to, first of all, again, you have to realize that there is a God. He does make all the rules, and that he defines what's right and what's wrong, and we don't. And when that again, just a basic concept of that is realized, then you get a little more interested in reading what's in this book. Because this defines what's right. Because we have to, people have to realize that, God's law defines what sin is. In fact, his character defines what righteousness is. So if we turn over to 3 John. Verse 11. Beloved, do not imitate what is evil, but what is good. And he who does good is of God. And he who does evil has not seen God. And another interesting thing here, if you read that verse, it says, if you do evil, you haven't seen God. That tells you the whole issue of seeing and hearing God. There are references there that are not always referring to physically seeing him with your eyes. That's a whole other subject. We've got a paper on the website that addresses that one. But one of the big arguments for why Christ has to be the God of the Old Testament is all tied around the whole issue of seeing and hearing God. If you realize, sometimes those references are not even referring to how we tend to take them. But an important thing to realize, and as we're about to see, this is tied right into the sacrificial system that was done during the Feast of Tabernacles that ancient Israel was commanded to do, is, as I mentioned, starting off with the beginning of the millennium. We oftentimes have an idealistic view of thinking, well, if Satan's out of the way and you have this peaceful environment, well, everybody will just want to jump right in line and learn all the finer points of God's word, and that's not really realistic. It's going to be a process of working with the very basics of people, and over time they'll develop this. And we're going to see that this is directly symbolized in the sacrificial system of what they were commanded to play out during the Feast of Tabernacles. And we're going to see that in the book of Numbers. But before we do that, let's turn over to Leviticus chapter 1. I'm going to cover a foundation of the burnt offerings, because you'll see in the first couple of chapters in the book of Leviticus, goes through the various types of sacrifices that were done. And there was a burnt sacrifice. And there's one of the things that's unique about it is if you study the sacrificial system, and there are various different types of sacrifices that are described in the book of Leviticus, you'll see in most cases, you know, when an animal was sacrificed, there were parts of that animal, you know, that either the priesthood or the people or both could consume, you know, themselves. There were, you know, parts that were maybe, you know, sacrificed to God or were burned, you know, but there's other parts where they would also have a meal out of. Well, with the burnt sacrifice, all of it was completely consumed and offered to God, you know, for atoning for sin. There was no part of it that any other humans, you know, got a benefit from this sacrifice. And we'll see here in Leviticus chapter 1 in verse 1. Now Jehovah called to Moses and spoke to him from the tabernacle of meeting, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when any one of you brings an offering to Jehovah, you shall bring your offering of the livestock of the herd of the flock. If this offering is a burnt sacrifice of the herd, let him who will offer the male without blemish, he shall offer it of his own free will at the door of the tabernacle of meeting before Jehovah. Then he shall put his hand on the head of the burnt offering, and it shall be accepted on his behalf to make atonement for him. And he shall kill the bull before Jehovah and the priests and Aaron's sons, and he shall bring the blood and sprinkle the blood around the altar that is on the door of the tabernacle of meeting. And he shall skin the burnt offering and cut it into pieces. And the sons of Aaron the priest shall put the fire on the altar and lay the wood in order on the fire. And the priests and Aaron's sons shall lay the parts of the head in the fat in order on the wood and the fire upon the altar. And he shall wash its entrails and its legs, and the priest shall burn all on the altar as a burnt sacrifice, and an offering made by fire, a sweet aroma to Jehovah." Now, what we're going to see here, just turn over to Romans, actually not Romans, Numbers chapter 29. Because in Numbers 28 and 29, what you have laid out there is all the sacrifices that were commanded to be done. You have, like, you know, the daily sacrifices, the new moon sacrifices, you know, all the holy days, you know, everything that is laid out there. But if you look at the details, you see something very interesting that takes place during the Feast of Tabernacles. And I think the symbolism ties into a lot of what we've been talking about today. Because I won't take the time to go through all of them. It's just going to kind of summarize some of this for you. But what you'll see is in all of the holy days, there was a combination of animals that were sacrificed each day. And again, this goes through all of, you know, from unleavened bread all the way through all of the holy days. Now, there's a combination of bulls, rams, and lambs that were done every day. Now, they're pretty uniform throughout most all the holy days, with the exception of the Feast of Tabernacles, and then something very interesting happens in the Feast of Tabernacles. Now, just to summarize this for you, throughout the spring holy days, it's very consistent. Every day, there's two bulls, one ram, and seven lambs, and these are all for the burnt offering, as I mentioned, where all of the meat is burned and consumed as an atonement offering to God, and there's no, you know, people don't get to eat it or benefit, you know, personally from the animal sacrifice. Now, for all of the fall holy days, with the exception of the Feast of Tabernacles, it's one bull, one ram, and seven lambs. But now what I want you to see is in the combinations for the Feast of Tabernacles, you'll see the numbers are much higher, but what I want you to pay attention to is the number of bulls. But because what you're going to see is every day in the Feast of Tabernacles, there's a descending amount of bulls that are offered each day as you go through all 7 days. And just to get a concept of, you know, the animals here and kind of what this would mean. Now, a bull, just to look at the size, you know, think of this in terms of the amount of meat or, like, you know, the financial impact this would have, you know, from a farming perspective of owning animals. Now, a bull is typically around 2,000 pounds or more. A ram would be like 200 pounds. A lamb would be like 100 pounds. So as you can see, you could take quite a number of rams and lambs together to equal the value of a single bull. You know, so notice that is like, I'm just going to kind of skip through this chapter here in this combination of animals that were offered each day during the Feast of Tabernacles. Let's start in Numbers chapter 29 and verse 12. On the 15th day of the seventh month, you shall have a holy convocation. You shall do no customary work, and you shall keep a feast to Jehovah 7 days. You shall present a burnt offering, an offering made by fire, and in a sweet aroma to the Lord. 13 young bulls, 2 rams, and 14 lambs in their first year, they shall be without blemish. Now again, if you do the math based upon the weights that I've given you, you know, the total number of, you know, rams and lambs would basically be about the equivalent of one bull. And in terms of, again, the amount of meat and, you might say, the financial investment that would be associated with this. But what I want you to see is it starts off at 13 bulls, and each day during the feast, there's one fewer every day. And by the seventh day of the feast, you're down to 7 bulls. Just to skip through this, jump down to verse 17. On the second day, present 12 young bulls, 2 rams, 14 lambs in their first year without blemish. Verse 20. On the third day, present 11 bulls, 2 rams, 14 lambs in their first year without blemish. Verse 23. On the fourth day, present 10 bulls, 2 rams, 14 lambs in their first year without blemish. Verse 26. On the fifth day, present 9 bulls, 2 rams, 14 lambs in their first year without blemish. Verse 29. On the sixth day, present 8 bulls, 2 rams, 14 lambs in their first year without blemish. And verse 32, on the seventh day, present 7 bulls, 2 rams, 14 lambs in their first year without blemish. Notice what's happening is, again, the bulls, which is going to be the primary amount of meat, you know, that's there, or even financial investment with it, it's descending each day as you're going forward. Now think about what the meaning of all of this is. This is offered as a sacrifice to God for the atonement for sin. If you're having to offer less and less each day, what does this suggest? Descending amounts of sin as you're going through. Because you started off with a number of people, again, many of them, it's news to them that there's a creator God, you know, and he's someone you should obey, and we're not equals, and he makes the rules, and, you know, you have to learn all these basic things before you start learning all the finer things of what you're supposed to obey. Well, as people get more and more in line and they learn and grow, well, you have less and less sin because you have more and more people, you know, starting to pay attention and obey. And you see this picture as it, you know, plays out over this 1,000-year period. And I think this is important for all of us to realize because, again, what is our job during all this period? Well, to be kings and priests. You know, to be those who teach and to work with these people, who help them to understand distinctions, you know, and as they grow and mature, to learn more and more of God's way and learn more and more of this book and how to apply it to themselves. But they're going to start off at a very basic level. Because again, oftentimes we get this idealistic view in our minds of, you know, well, Satan is bound and the earth is healed and the millennium starts and everybody just falls into obedience and it's all perfect from day one. Again, makes for great anecdotal stories, has very little correlation with reality, you know, and we have to realize that people are going to go through that growth period. And is, again, as Rick talked about yesterday, how do we need to rule them? With patience, with kindness, you know, with maybe, you know, realizing that this is a big learning curve for them, and we have to slowly work with them at where they're at as they learn and grow and develop throughout this process. And again, we see this directly pictured in the sacrificial system that was commanded to be done during the Feast of Tabernacles. It shows us this very lesson. So brethren, as we go forward throughout this week, you know, learning more and more about what our roles are here, let's just realize we're having a realistic view of what this time frame is going to look like and what our job is. And again, it's very much practicing the very principles that Rick told us about yesterday of love and kindness and patience and working with these people, because they're going to start off at a very basic level, But our job is to meet them where they're at and then to help them to eventually get to perfection.